Good morning, good morning, good morning, and thank you for joining me on another episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have an amazing show for you today. Today's guests are different, interesting, diverse, a lot of different areas, different backgrounds, but you know how we do it here at the Roundtable Talk Show. We bring it all together in an organic, entertaining, educational conversation. So you want to go ahead and grab your notepad, your recorder, whatever it is that you need to get to obtain this information, because I guarantee you, you are going to learn something. So before we go ahead and introduce today's guest, I'm going to invite you to do what I always invite you to do, and that is to go out and share this show, because friends don't let friends miss out on the Roundtable Talk Show. Now, while you're doing that, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first guest, Mr. Isaiah Frizzle. He is an actor, writer, podcaster, fitness trainer, and so much more. I'm pretty sure we're also going to hear some tales about his journey as an entrepreneur. Good morning, Isaiah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you for that intro. How are you doing?
It's so much more that we can include. And I just wanted to ask you, are you an entrepreneur?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I kind of thought so, because when I was looking at your information, it's like actors, they always have to find something else to do in the meantime, and then they're hardly ever satisfied. So I'm like, I know there's some hustle in there in order for you to be successful. So Isaiah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh man, there's a lot of hustle. And I think as an actor, you fail to realize how much you do. So for me, my journey has been very much a diverse one. Where it's not linear. I've worked in, not just as an actor, but I've worked in production for, I think, a good 10 years. You know, I've done a lot of camera work, behind the scenes work, which I think lent itself to acting. I have a double degree in psychology and filmmaking. So while I was in school and running for auditions, I was also, you know, hit the books, get my studies in, and now I just parlay all of that to just my daily living. So the psychology lends itself, one, to acting, to filmmaking, but also to podcasting. And, you know, the filmmaking in itself, you just pick up a lot of skills, you know, technical skills, but also people skills along the way. And then there's fitness training. You know, as an actor, you want to stay fit, but it's also a mental component that lends itself to who you are, how you operate throughout the day. But people don't necessarily always realize at first, but whenever I'm training or I have clients, I tell them specifically, I'm like, look, it's not just about looking good, it's about feeling good. So it starts here. And to have the, I think the capacity to even exercise, it takes a lot of mental fortitude, because exercise is not, it's not fun always, you know, it's a lot of work. And then you have to have that space to want to keep getting up, but also to want better for yourself. You know, it's those little components in the work, you know, that are important, that play a pivotal role in just how you show up. So I apply all of that to acting, to podcasting, to fitness training, to writing. I understand first, it's how I think and how I feel. Everything else falls in line afterwards.
It seems diverse. It seems like you have psychology over here, you have acting over here, you have writing, you have podcasting, but it would seem to me the psychology aspect would allow you to really get into the character, because you're trying to understand their mind, you're trying to understand what they're thinking, what they're going through, and so you most likely put a lot more thought into the character than some people who just say, you know, I want to act.
Right. It's I've talked to a few people who have been like, yeah, I want to be an actor. It seems like fun. And I'm like, that's cool. I'm like, that's cool. I'm like, you know, but think about what it is that you're signing up for. You know, as an actor, you play a lot of different roles. You know, you play a lot of different roles, a lot of different characters, a lot of different stories. Some could be a little bit more close to home. Others could be so far removed from you. So it's like, it's the matter of understanding you first and then put yourself into a character. And sometimes it just hits a little bit different. You know, there are some roles where it's just like, I don't even want to touch that because that's a little bit too close for me. And other ones you're like, yeah, I'll just jump into it. You know, playing a villain, playing a criminal, you know, things like that. somebody's like, yeah, that's easy for me. Because
Mm-hmm.
you're it doesn't apply to you. As to where someone may have had like a very triggering and visceral experience, and they're like, yeah, something about this role I just don't sit well with. And if you do the work, and by work, I always say the work is the work you do on yourself. Not the work you do for everyone else, but it's the work you do on yourself. Like once you understand yourself a little bit more, you know why this doesn't work, why this works, why this is so appealing to you, why you're so repulsed by something else. And that just allows you to navigate a little bit different. So as an actor, it helps to know yourself first and add that to the role, but also understanding, you know, am I removed from this or is this a little bit too close?
Mm-hmm.
And how am I, you know, working through it?
I like that. I like that. I'm going to come back to you, Isaiah. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest. And I actually want some of his feedback because he's done a little bit in the entertainment arena as well. Mr. Alan Klein. Alan Klein is an award-winning speaker, TEDx presenter, and author of, okay, guys, you won't even believe this, but he is the author of 31 books. Okay, 31 books. Including the bestseller, The Healing Power of Humor, as well as You Can't Ruin My Day, and Embracing Life After Loss. Actor Jerry Lewis has said that Alan Klein is a noble and vital force watching over the human condition. So we want to welcome him to the Roundtable Talk Show. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I sometimes when I hear the introduction, I go, is that me? It's like,
that's what they sent me, Alan. That's what they sent me. So if that's not you, let me know.
Yeah, that's fine. It's me, but it's you know, I'm getting up in years and I look back at my life and I thought, you know, if I die tomorrow, I've done stuff to help other people. And that was my goal. And to do that. So I love what Isaiah said, a couple of things. One is about choice, that you all, that your attitude, that, you know, do you wake up in the morning grumpy or do you wake up happy? It's always like your intention, no matter what you're doing in life, it's your intention. My TED Talk, in fact, is all about the power of intention. So every morning I wake up, and maybe that's why I've written so many books, is like, well, I intend to, you know, do this morning or share that with people, or but have a goal for the day, because otherwise your life goes by and you go, you know, how did this happen? And I guess
I want to know how it happened, because how did you get to 31 books? That's, I mean, like, take us back to the first book. That's what I want to know.
Okay. So, again, I just want to touch on what Isaiah said before.
Oh, go ahead. You know, absolutely.
Because it all will tie in. You'll see. but you said, you know, a lot of people come to you, I want to be an actor. Well, when I was writing my books, people say, I want to be an author. You know, I want. And yet people, you say, how did you write it? The main goal of being an author is sit down and write. I have a friend for the last, I would say, 15 years, he's been writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I speak to him, I go, well, have you written, you know, what have you written? Well, you know, I didn't have time today, or I did. Getting a book written, I'm at my desk at 9 a.m. I walk, you know, have lunch. I then write some more. I walk the dog at 3 o'clock. I come back, I write till 5. It's a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I can't say I want to be an author and write for a half hour a day. I'm not going to get it done. But
right.
If you write, just think about this. If you write one page a day, every single day, how many pages would you have at the end of the year?
Right.
You'd have a book.
Yes.
So, The big thing about getting anything done is just go do it and make time for it, schedule it. And for being a writer and author, just sit down and however you do it, you can talk it on a cassette tape or on your phone these days. You could talk it into your computer and it writes it out. I mean, you don't even have to type it out anymore. So just do it. You got to do it.
That is wonderful advice from someone who has written 31 books. I really believe, and I may be wrong, so forgive me for anyone else who's been on the show, but I think 31 has been the most amount of books a person, an author, has had as a guest on the Roundtable Talk Show. So you get an award. Right. I don't know what the award is.
What do I win?
I don't know yet. That's a surprise at the end of the show. We'll get to that. But I want to come back to you, Alan. I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, Jody Andes. Jody has an almost unbelievable true crime book that came out this year that she is spreading the word about, not only for the book, but so we learn. Her book is Master of Deceit. Good morning, Jody. How are you?
Good morning. I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me here. I've learned already from Alan and Isaiah. And Isaiah, may I say that I think you could follow Alan's footsteps. I could see you doing a TEDx someday. I'm just saying.
It's the goal. Thank you for saying that.
But I agree with Alan. Yeah, Alan, don't laugh, but my book took 8 years to do. It's true crime, and it was an amazing amount of research. It's, like I said, the most bizarre story. Do you all remember when it was back when Obama was in office, that couple, the Salahis, made their way into a big formal dinner? And it was a big brouhaha. Well, just a year before that happened, a guy by the name of Bobby Thompson was allowed into the Oval Office with President Bush, and he was wanted for espionage. And it is an amazing story. He was using a fake name, and he was scamming the country. He was scamming our veterans, and he was using the money to get close to politics. And it's an eye-opening story of how money works in this country, but set with a narrative tone, because he was a bright fella. He grew up just, you know, very mediocre, and he was in media and intelligence, possibly with the CIA, and he snapped one day and went to a life of crime. I don't know why, I guess for my grandfather, I'm a big fan of the military. I mean, they do things that I wish I had the guts to do. And I was very motivated for them because they were scammed out of $100 million.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And nobody was really, only the state of Ohio prosecuted this guy. And I really wanted to see it through for them.
So you just stopped what you were doing and said, I got to write this book.
I was like Alan. You know, I worked at night. I worked weekends. I used my vacations. But you have to carve out that time. And I would also say to young writers, just let it flow. Take the time, like Alan said. And, you know, just like I'm talking to you, pretend you're talking to someone. And, you know, whatever you are telling them of interest, your readers are going to find that of interest as well. And no writer makes it perfect on the first draft. So don't worry about it. Just get started.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when you wrote the book, Jody, was there I ask difficult questions sometimes, so I'm gonna just try to phrase this, but was there like a agenda that you had with the book? Like, did you say, let me write this book so it could come into a movie or more people could be aware, or that this doesn't happen again?
It was a couple things, and mm-hmm. I do have a group of producers. I'll be stepping into Isaiah's world. They'll be either interested in doing a documentary on the book. But there was three things. One, that he stole from our veterans, and I could not believe nobody was going to stand up for them. So we asked them to possibly give their life for us, and when they get ripped off, we're just supposed to let it go. Mm-hmm. Two, it was a huge national security risk. So I don't care about your politics. I don't care where you fall. But this guy who was wanted, Bobby Thompson, whose real name is John Donald Cody, was wanted for espionage and used a fake stolen ID. That's how he got in. That's how he got approved. If he could do that by giving money, what can our enemies do? He pretty much laid out a blueprint for how to get close to all of our national leaders, our president, and Lord knows what could happen. And if we don't learn from our past, we're doomed by it. So that was the second reason. And third, charitable giving. There were 43 agencies that had approved this organization. So they were soliciting all over the country, and the whole organization was fake. There wasn't a real member. There wasn't one real board of director. There wasn't even one office. They were all like UPS boxes. And it just continued to fascinate me. I couldn't put it down.
So what was your first step? What did you do? Like when you, this case is national news, you're not directly, from my understanding, involved in it. So what do you do? Just walk? Okay, go ahead.
Well, kind of. I was a reporter.
Okay, that's what I was missing. Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. A reporter for most of my career. And as newspapers decided, as newspapers began to downsize, I took a job as a chief investigator for the Ohio Attorney General. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to root out corruption in his own office. So he wanted a reporter to pretty much attack it like anyone would from the outside. Anyways, this case came up and the first assistant attorney general came to me and said, hey, our normal investigators are really struggling. It's a huge fraud case. There's nothing to bite into. Can you tell me what a reporter would see? And I did. I tore into it and I'm like, oh, he's got a girlfriend in New York City. And he's like, how do you know? And I'm like, oh, dude, he's like, he was whining and dining. He was getting non-smoking rooms. He was getting a limo. If that's not a man courting a woman, I don't know what is. Sorry, guys.
I got that woman intuition. You just looked at it and go, there's a woman here. Absolutely. I want to come back to you, Jody, but I want to go ahead and introduce our next guest, Miss Wendy Hillard, Hall of Fame rhythmic gymnast, who was the first Black woman to represent the United States in international competition and founder of the Wendy Hillard Gymnastics Foundation, headquartered in Harlem. She's a trailblazer and leader in the gymnastics, nonprofit, and Black community. Good morning, Wendy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. It's been very interesting already.
You are so welcome. Thank you for joining us. I love your books and your background. I'm a gymnast.
Yeah. That was from one of the books. Photographer Jane Feldman did a photo essay on my gymnast here. That's Mackenzie, who's now like 25 years old or so. Mm-hmm. But it was really exciting. It just tells your story of being a young gymnast and then my family and things like that.
Yeah, the quantum leaps that you've made.
Yeah, that's my sister. So my sister is a number one salesperson for Mary Kay, and she's also a big motivational speaker. So that's her book.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Wendy, tell us why you were so passionate about gymnastics.
It was just something I love to do. I mean, I like most young people, saw it on the TV at the Olympics, and I went outside. I wanted to do it. But I grew up in Detroit, so I'm from Detroit, Michigan. And when we started, there wasn't a lot of gymnastics in the city. So I went to the Y and I did tumbling, but I wanted to do the full gymnastics, right? What they call it, artistic gymnastics, the bars, the beam. So we had to go out to the suburbs. So my mother drove me out to the suburbs and she wasn't liking it very much because it was expensive and it wasn't diverse. So we were at the Jewish Community Center and they had these two coaches that were from the former Soviet Union. And my mom really convinced the city of Detroit to hire them as coaches. So they came back to the city. They were part of the recreation department. So we had this really wild team where we had these, actually two more coaches came over, four coaches, and all of these gymnasts from the recreation department. We became one of the best teams in the country. So from that background, I went on and competed at three world championships. And then I moved to New York. I finished school at NYU and I coached. My gymnast made the Olympic team in 96. During this time, I was doing a lot of broadcasting and performing, Broadway, but I really, I became president of the Women's Sports Foundation, and I really found out through a lot of ups and downs I had in my career to become an advocate for kids, and I wanted them to be able to have the opportunity I had because it was very expensive. There weren't a lot of Blacks in the sport, so I started my foundation, and we've almost going on 25 years. We've served almost 25,000 kids. We expanded to Detroit 5 years ago. And it's really, it's a joy for me. And people don't understand. They think in gymnastics because of Simone Biles and Gabby Douglas and Dominique Dawes. There are a lot of Black gymnasts there, but on the grassroots, there's not. And there is, to have the opportunity, and many of the kids that come to my program come because they feel comfortable. It's not like they can't take gymnastics. It's usually in the suburbs. But if you go there as a child of color, oftentimes you're one of the few, and that's not always comfortable. But when you come to my program, my coaches have great staff. They're all great gymnasts. They were great gymnasts. They're great coaches. So it's a really warm environment, but we really push quality. I mean, my coaches, I told you, from the Soviet Union, they were not playing. I like good gymnastics. I just don't think it should be so costly. And especially during this time, it's really a lot of attention of how young people have to keep motivated, have to keep moving, and to be in an environment where they, if they're passionate about gymnastics, they can come on over to me and we'll make sure they're taken care of. But overall, we have to support our young people and keep them healthy. So that's really one of my main motivations.
Absolutely. I love it. Now, you mentioned a couple of people or a few people in gymnastics that are of color, but that has been relatively within the last, 20, 25 years, like you mentioned. Now, when you were starting out and you mentioned that you were a representative in the Black community, were there instances where people tried to stop you or say, you know what, gymnastics is not a Black girl sport?
Constantly. I mean, it wasn't. And the one story that really impacted me the most is that in rhythmic gymnastics, that's the sport with the ribbons and the hoops. I did all the types of gymnastics, but I fell on rhythmic. And so we were preparing for the world championships, and I'd already been on two world championship teams. So what you do is you go to the Olympic Training Center in Colorado, you stay for 6 weeks, they have about 14 kids go, and they kind of have two teams. So you have an A team and a B team, and I was on the A team, and you're training. And then they bring you to the room and they say, this is gonna be our team going to the world championships. And they read off the names, and they didn't read my name. And I was shocked. All of the teammates were shocked. My personal coach was there, and everybody knew something was off. And, you know, it's like, how come Wendy's not on the team? And so I went up to the coach and I said, you know, how come I'm not on the team? And she says, Wendy, you stand out too much. You're in a group routine. We need everybody to look alike and you stand out. And I was shocked. I was like, yeah, this is the early 80s. And I was like, I didn't think that you could do that personally. And so I called my parents, but I was devastated. I called them, and my father and mother were like, no, baby. Let's call USA Gymnastics, because not everything that they had been through in their lives, they're going to tell their daughter, because she was Black, she couldn't do gymnastics. So we sent, you know, it's the old days, a telegram or whatever, telefax to USA Gymnastics, and they knew that it wasn't something that they could hold up. So they said, just take the team from the national championships. I was qualified in the top, and so I was able to go to the world championships. But that taught me that I may have to fight for gymnastics, that people still, I mean, it's you at the time, because I was an athlete and I was just wanted to do this, but it happens a lot. I have friends in ballet. It happens a lot in that. When you talk about those types of things, and I went to the same thing as an athlete. I do, you know, really well in the US, but when I went to Europe, they were like, this is a Euro, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. I always had higher scores and lots of medals when I went to Europe, but I had a fight at home, and this is going back a long time. So I knew early on, and that's why I became an advocate for the right to compete on many different levels, whether it's your color, whether it's your gender, whether it's abilities. Kids and adults need to have the opportunity and right to compete.
Absolutely. I want to go over to Isaiah real quick. Listening to Wendy, part of your focus is being a fitness trainer. One of the things that I believe as a society that we need to do is find ways, like Wendy was saying, to get more children fit and get the obesity levels down. What are your thoughts, Isaiah?
So I agree with Wendy wholeheartedly. First off, very inspiring story. But I agree in the sense of there is this, it should be top priority, I think, to just, and I don't want to say mold kids, but let's say inspire kids to, one, be actively fit. Because my generation, you know, growing up, you couldn't keep us in the house, you know? And I think nowadays there's this complete shift where kids don't really go outside at all. You know, everything is done through your phone, through the computer. And it's weird. What I find is happening in such a weird way is, like, physically there's been a deficit, but there's been a lot more awareness to emotional triggers, mental health triggers. All these things kind of are creeping up in society. But I think as children, yeah, it's important to let them know, hey, get outside, get a little dirty. Make friends, have conversations, watch what you eat, because it does affect you. It does affect you. And I think, I've worked around kids for a stint, and it's interesting when they are just allowed to experience life versus when they're kind of sheltered and public. How they move and how they just experience other people is night and day. So it is important to teach them, hey, pay attention to what you eat. And I tell adults too, when I train clients, I'm like, pay attention to how you feel when you eat this thing. What's your favorite food? Oh, that's your favorite food? Okay, cool. So next time you eat it, I want you to pay attention to your mood. I want you to pay attention to your food. So what I mean by that is like, before you even eat this thing, why do you go for it? What's your mental state before you go and grab this bag of Doritos or that soda or the beer, whatever the case may be? And how do you feel afterwards? Because if you start to notice that, it becomes a correlation between your stress and how you decide to relieve it or get away from it. So if you can figure that out as a child, in some way, shape, or form, as an adult, you have a little bit more wherewithal. How you fix your plate.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. So
Yeah.
we, you know, so again, you have different extremes. So you have the fitness trainer, you know, so we talk a little bit about the kids from Wendy, but with Jody has this, to me, I feel like the Erin Brockovich kind of incredible story of this is your life and you're trying to figure this out. And then all of a sudden it's a book that turns into a movie. So when Jody was speaking, what were your thoughts, Isaiah?
Oh man, when Jody was speaking, I was like, it's for one, I think that's such a it's a crazy story when you think about it, because some people are just like, oh man, that's cool. You're uncovering this whole plot line, or you're digging deep, you're doing all this research. But when you really break it down, it's like, that's a lot of work. You don't really sleep. But also too, and Jody, I'm not sure like if you were ever worried about your own safety, because the thing about it is, I don't feel like you're just uncovering one person. There's a lot of people involved that may not want to be, found out. So it's like, all right, who's this person looking up all this information? What are they doing? Where do they live? Where's their family? It becomes a whole nother plot line in itself of, you protecting yourself the entire time. You're trying to be as diplomatic and as patriotic as possible. You put yourself at risk in terms of being compromised. So I think it's brave. It's a lot of work and it's scary, and sometimes it can be a very thankless job too, trying
Can
to
I
be
say
right,
something to Jody? Can I ask?
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So, Jody, you kind of said like you spent 8 years on the book, and I think that's very brave to keep at it for 8 years. Because when I wrote my first book, The Healing Power of Humor, there was no computer. And I remember sitting in the library for days, months. There was an article about humor in death and dying and grief that I had read about somewhere, and it was going to be in the New York Times in a certain year. So I wanted to do research. Most of you probably don't remember microfiche.
Yes, I do. I
And
remember
there
it.
was
I've
this
heard it in school
bundle.
time.
And you had to sit and wind it. And so I sat and went through a whole year's worth of the New York Times looking for this one article, and I couldn't find it. So I finally researched the, talking about doing research, who the author was, finally contacted the author. Now there's no computer, there's no email, so it's a letter, it's researching in the library. I even joined a medical library. I had to pay money to do that to get information. But anyhow, finally I contact the author, and he writes back and he says, yes, I wrote that article, and there was a big news story that day, and the New York Times cut the article. Therefore, it was not in. And here I had sat for like, I don't know, a week with the microfiche, and he sent me the article. But I know what you go through when you do research and you want to turn every corner and every page. And We are so lucky to have the computer these days to do that kind of, and you know, now if I put in therapeutic humor or humor in death, I'll get what, 100,000
results
leads that I'd have. So it's, that's not, that's like overwhelm too much. But at those days, there wasn't much about therapeutic humor. There was so little and very hard to find.
Yes, it's a lot of research. Go ahead, Jody.
Well, I also wanted to ask Wendy, because I don't know much about, I love watching gymnastics, but I don't know what is rhythmic and what other kinds are there. Could you give us a little lesson on what that is?
Sure. So gymnastics as a term is movement on or with equipment. So most people are familiar with gymnastics on equipment. That's what they call in English artistic gymnastics. That's on the balance beam, on the parallel bars for men, on the floor exercise. Rhythmic gymnastics is movement with equipment, with hand apparatus, like a 19-foot ribbon, a ball, a hoop. And so it's still the coordination. All of it is coordination, hand-eye coordination, especially in rhythmic gymnastics. So rhythmic gymnastics has been an Olympic sport since 1984. Another Olympic sport in gymnastics is trampoline. So everyone's familiar with trampolines. Well, since 2000, it has been an individual Olympic sport. And then there's also tumbling, which is just people going down a long floor and flipping as fast and hard and twisting as much as they can. So they have gymnastics where hand balancing is called acrobatics in general. So you just think of gymnastics as movement with or on apparatus. And so those are the different disciplines. And my discipline was rhythmic gymnastics. It's also performed to music. So it's very artistic, and you have to coordinate not only your movement with the equipment, but with the music as well.
Mm-hmm. And when they do it in the swimming pool, what, you know, the, I love that. What?
That's synchronized swimming.
Yeah. That's so beautiful.
I don't do gymnastics in the pool, but.
Isaiah, I think you said some, had something to say.
I was asking Winnie, I was like, was that your favorite, what's the word I'm looking for? Your favorite, okay. Say that again?
Event or discipline?
Yes.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the thing is that I started tumbling. I used to tumble a lot, and then I went to artistic gymnastics. And what happened is my coach, Zina Meridov, who is from Ukraine, was a specialist in rhythmic gymnastics. And so she came over, we argued about it. She passed away, but we used to argue. I say she recruited me because I was such a good gymnast. And she said I begged her to teach me rhythmic, but I'm like, Zina, I didn't know what it was. So it was just happenstance that she was a master sport, and she brought this sport, this discipline to us. So for me, my favorite in the sport of gymnastics actually is watching men's gymnastics. That's my favorite of all gymnastics. But in rhythmic gymnastics, I was very good at the hula hoop and the ribbon. And in artistic gymnastics, I was a very good tumbler.
I like that. You got to push your boundaries and go past where you, what you think you can do, which I want to go back to Jody to answer the question that Isaiah initially asked about your research and your concerns for your own safety.
Isaiah, you hit it right on that nail. I was nervous. You know, there was nobody this Bobby Thompson wasn't pictured with, from McConnell to Kasich to, you name the big Republican, and he was with him, Karl Rove. And let's be honest, I'm from a small town in Ohio, and those guys have lawyers that they can sue at the drop of a hat. And so that's part of the reason it took me so long, because I wanted to be dead certain of my facts. So that was part of the reason. And one thing I've noticed, I find this an interesting thread among all the guests, is just the remarkable acts that started small. Wendy, you are amazing. And not only are you amazing, I think your mom and dad were too, because God loved them for not sitting back and making that example and showing you no way. And it doesn't seem like any one of us are from very affluent or great backgrounds. You know, we were just average people trying to do remarkable things, but it takes time and it takes effort and it takes belief that you can. And So yeah, I always tease my 21-year-old son who always jokes with Alexa, makes some weird comment. I'm like, oh my God, the CIA could be listening in. Don't do that.
Yes, you never know these days. They always say Big Brother is definitely watching. But when we listen to these stories, Jody, in my mind, I always think of some cloak and dagger mission where you're trying to do the research and then there's this office you have to go to and this office is the only office where they have the information and you try to go there and they stonewall you. See, I could write this. See, Isaiah, I could write this whole movie by myself.
It is. I had to, he had computer records on him. So when he was on the run for years running through the country, he had these flash drives and these computer records. And when they caught him, they seized him. And at first the government wouldn't give him out. And I was like, that's bogus. You guys submitted them in court as part of court record. So I had to sue the attorney general. And then I had to get 5 different computer experts because nobody could crack it open. And, I was like, I was determined. I'm like, man, why did he keep this with him? Mm-hmm. And it was worth it.
You were adamant.
Yeah. Was there at any point you were like, I should give up, or it got to the point where you were a little bit afraid, or you were like getting some subtle kind of threats of like, hey, listen, you better stop. You know, did it ever get to that point, or was it just like it was a fluid process? Obviously, you know, tedious for 8 years, but like ever a point where you were just like, okay, maybe this is not for me anymore because I'm not safe.
Not so much. Through it all, my mom developed brain cancer, and I was a caregiver, and she was so brave through that. And she wanted me to do the book, I mean, so much. And like I said, with veterans, it really amazed me. I would have loved to have joined the military, but I think I would have done nothing but laps and push-ups for years because I would just be questioning people, why? I was, but, you know, I don't know. I just kept pushing forward. It was just something I felt I had to do.
Mm-hmm. I kind of thought about joining the military too. They called me when I was in high school, but I said, you guys do more before 9 a.m. than I do all day. So that was not for me, not for the faint of heart. So I'm telling you, I don't like to do all of that. But what's interesting to me, Jody, and what I'm curious, because I see this whole thing in my mind's eye. Was there anything that happened when you finished the book?
Well, the funniest thing to me, and Alan, you probably could have some insight in this, but so Bobby Thompson, whose real name is John Donald Cody, he's quite the character. I mean, he's a mastermind and he's also very manipulative. And I had got him to talk to me as part of the book. And so that was a huge deal because he hadn't talked to anybody. But when the book was finally done, I didn't know what kind of reaction I was going to get, even though he's locked up in prison in Ohio. But the reaction I got surprised me, and that was he was pissed because the book cost $17. He wanted it higher. He thought, hey, man, this is my story. It should be a whole lot more. And he wrote a whole business proposal and how I should do it. And I'm like, well, I didn't see that one coming.
You never can understand. Alan, have you ever had these experiences in your 31 books? Like,
I've had so many, incredible experiences. And you just have to kind of push through. My very first book, The Healing Power of Humor, I had an incredible editor. And the book was then titled Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying. Mm-hmm. And she said, never change that title. She said, that is a New York Times best-selling title. Mm-hmm. So I was writing the book. 9 months later, she left the company and I got a new editor who was not so great, but I just kept writing. And the book came out in the publishers at that time did a catalog, like the spring edition. It would come out in the spring, catalog would be published in the fall. Bookstores would pre-order and it did. There it was in the catalog as Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying. And they only pre-sold 5,000 copies. And they said that wasn't enough. We're pulling the book. We're going to change the title to The Healing Power of Humor and put it out the following season. And so they put it out the following season. Guess how many pre-orders they got?
50,000. The same amount?
Same amount. It did no difference in what title they used. And I really think the first title was better, but the book is in a 40 plus printing in 12 foreign language. So I guess Healing Power of Humor was a pretty good title. But wouldn't it be great to go back and reissue it and see, you know, but we can't do that. There's so many different, when you're an author, there's so many different incredible experiences. In fact, the book that I have coming out in December, which is the AWE Factor, How a Little Bit of Wonder Could Make a Big Difference in Your Life. It's the ninth book with this particular publisher. And that all came about because Random House was publishing some of my books, and then they closed that division because they were saving money. And so those series of books were not printed anymore. I got the rights back. And for 2 years, I struggled to try to get them reprinted with other publishers. Nobody wanted it. So one day I go to a meeting, and a speaker I wanted to hear for many years, it was about getting published and getting publicity. And this rows of chairs, and I sit down on the aisle, and I hear the man next to me turning around, talking to two women, saying, he's trying to sell them his book. And I hear them say, "We've just started a brand new division of the company we work for, a very successful company. And we're looking, that division is going to publish uplifting, motivational books. And we're looking for new titles." And I turned around and I said, "I have seven of those that Random House is no longer printing." And so they gave me the card and they said, "Well, send us the books and we'll look at them." I looked at the card, and there were two miracles here. This is my awe book, because I think this is a moment of awe. I looked at the card, and their office was three blocks from where I lived.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
So I took the book to them the next day, and they started to publish them. And then they got too big for their little office near where I lived. So they moved to a big warehouse, had a big party, and I was invited, and I walk in, and this woman comes up to me and she says, "I'm so glad you're with us. I own this company. You haven't seen me around because I live in London." She said, "But I know about you for 11 years. And I said, how do you know me? She said, "For 11 years, I live right across the street from you."
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. It's just amazing how many doors can just open when you least expect it, just come from nowhere. That is amazing.
That's like the next part of the next book is, you know, because for me, that's an awe moment. It's like so many, I could have sat anywhere else in that. First of all, I could have not gone to that meeting. I could have sat anywhere else in the room. These two women could have not been talking to this man, you know.
And they couldn't, maybe they weren't open to it. You know, sometimes when people are having a conversation and you like, "Hey, I got this," they're like, "Wait a minute, who was talking to you? We were having our own private conversation."
Right.
The doors kind of just opened up. I love it. Wendy, have you ever had any of those awe moments that Alan described?
You know, I was just thinking about that as he was speaking, and I'm sure I have, and I don't. It's hard to put it in context, but I will say it was very interesting. So, in 2012, when Gabby Douglas was competing, it was two things. So I had my foundation. Gabby was competing at Madison Square Garden, and so I just wanted my kids and my. I always call them all my kids. I have two kids, wonderful husband and two boys, but my gymnastics kids. I wanted them to go see live gymnastics. So I got like 250 of them down in Madison Square Garden to watch his gymnastics. And when I was there, Gabby was actually the alternate, meaning that her scores weren't counted. It's a big competition called the American Cup. But then I saw her and I was like, oh my gosh, this gymnast is so good. They weren't focusing on her, but I was like, she could win the Olympic Games. And this was before the Olympics. And people didn't know this, but you know, she was not the top person at the time. I was gonna go to the London Olympics. And so my husband's family is there. And I just right at that moment knew that she could do it. Part of it, to be honest with you, is that I knew if the Olympics were in the US, it'd be harder for her to win. But I'm like, dang, we're gonna be in Europe. I was like, we're not gonna be in the US. Yes, this has got a chance. Seriously, I mean, Black people understand that well, right? So the awe moment for this story is that when we got to London, the gymnastics tickets were so hard to get. And I know a lot of people in the Olympic movement, working on getting the Olympics. So my friend who was working for NBC knew I wanted to go see Gabby compete, because in my head, I was like, I gotta see it. And he says, Wendy, you can have my ticket. You can go to gymnastics.
That's cool.
And it was the most amazing thing because, you know, when you're there, I don't think people understand. They do because you see it on TV. But as a gymnast, it is the most difficult thing. And it's really about your head. You have to understand. Everybody competes. Everybody trains. They're very good. But you have to have it in your head that you can do this. And Gabby was on the balance beam. And I knew she had to get through balance beam because it's, you know, only 4 inches wide, right? She's flipping all over it, and she has ups and downs with it. When she hit her beam, I was over the top. It, for me as a Black woman, to see Gabby Douglas win the Olympic gold medal was awesome. And then my awe moment was that my good friend, he says, Wendy, I know you really want to see this. Here's my ticket.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Wow.
That's cool.
In your career, Isaiah, what are your awe moments?
My awe moments, I was like, oh man, where are some odd moments for me? I will say there's two, one not so related to my career, but another one, I got a mentor out of it. So there was, I'll do the one that's not related to my career first. So I was just hanging out in the park when I was living back in New York. And my friend and I, we were walking, we just got out of work, we were walking. And I saw someone drop their wallet. And I think I was just talking to her about like moving to California, you know, wanting to make the transition or anything like that. And we were just having a good conversation. I saw this wallet. I'm like, I think these people just dropped this wallet. So I ran up to them, gave them the wallet. They're like, oh, thank you very much. I'm like, yeah, no problem. So we're sitting there. And about 5 minutes later, they come back with like this cookie. And they're like, yeah, we just want to say thank you. They're like, we're from California and, you know, we're just here on a trip. And that was everything that we had. So thank you for bringing it back to us. I was like, wow, yeah, no problem. And it was like a moment of clarity for me because we were just having a conversation about California. As far as my mentor, I ended up becoming very good friends with this guy. Because someone else had backed out of an event and I showed up, and from that point on, I was working with him closely for about 3 or 4 years because of that one time of like someone else not being present. And he was like, I, from the day we met, he was like, I knew what you were going to do and how you were going to go about things. And he was like, I'm not surprised you are where you are right now.
So. Oh, that's beautiful. That sounds like one of those mentors we probably recognize if we mention the name. So yeah. I'm like, yeah, that was great.
Bobby. Yeah, he called me recently and I hadn't talked to him, and probably about 2 years since I've been out here. And he was like, I just want to let you know, I caught up on your podcast. And he was like, I listened to damn near every episode. Because it's been 2 years now, and I took a break over the summer to finish writing a book. And that was like, so you figure about 8 episodes I didn't record. So he was like, I listened to your podcast. And he was like, keep doing what you're doing because the world needs more of that. He was like, I just want to let you know. Oh man, it hit me. And it was the perfect time. And he was like, I just want to let you know. And it's something that I've always told him. He was like, keep doing what you're doing because who you are is what the world needs more of. He was like, I'm proud of you.
See, that was great.
Yeah.
Jody, what is your awe moment?
When I was a journalist, there was a huge scam that was in federal court, and one of the defendants took off and left, and she was this millionaire in real, let's say hoity, let's be honest. And so she disappeared and nobody was looking for her. And again, I got a burr up my backside and went and did a lot of research, and it prompted the marshals to ultimately find her. And so the federal judge in the case pulled me back and he said, listen, I know newspapers are dying. And if you ever want a job recommendation, I am here for you. I thought, no, I can't accept that from a judge. But then as we knew layoffs were close, I went back to him and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to have to. And I think I'd like to go work for Richard Cordray. And I guess I'll do communications. And you talk about the aha moment. He goes, do you know that Cordray's first assistant was my law clerk, and they need a senior investigator, that they want somebody special to do things? And it all fall together. And it was just, you know, if I didn't do the story, if I didn't go in to talk to him, and you know, it was kismet.
I think that's beautiful. And what stands out in everybody's awe moment is that they personally took some type of action, some type of step. Because people always talk about, because I don't believe in happenstance. I don't believe in coincidence. I believe that we create the opportunities. Even Alan, he initiated his 7 books by starting the conversation. Most people, most scary people, or most people who didn't have that confidence may have overheard the conversation, but most likely they would have said, you know what, I have these books, they're not talking to me, and they would went on with their lives. But we all took an action, we all took a step to make it happen, and I think that's wonderful. Now we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show, and what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching this show live, as well as everyone who is watching in the archives, and let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today. And I'm going to start with you, Wendy.
Oh, okay. There we go. Well, first I want to say my friend is Shane Garrity. So he's the one that gave me that ticket. I didn't mention his name. He's a great friend. I would say that I really want the audience to know that it's so important that we support our youth. As you know, Isaiah was talking about this, but it's a critical time. I mean, they're at home now, and what we're doing and what I do in my work and what people, the teachers are doing, everybody's out here trying to make it work, but this is affecting our kids a lot, and it's going to be very important. We have to make sure that there's equal opportunity for young people to have some joy. Let's talk about it. We've got to have some joy in whatever you're doing. It's critical. What I do with my work, and we're struggling here, as we've all talked about this, you know, we're not in our space because I do public spaces, but people that can afford gymnastics and private clubs are doing gymnastics. Now I'm like, working so hard to keep the kids going. And you know what? It's worth it. It's something that this investment that you have in youth to make sure that they are supported, that they can express themselves, whatever it may be. We do it through gymnastics, and we do it that all kids deserve it. Kids of color deserve it. All kids deserve it. And so my message is to be stay open, stay positive, stay joyful, and really make sure that you are giving to the youth and giving back, because when you give back, you support the general energy that's in this world, and it'll come back to you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Wendy. Isaiah, what do you have for us?
Kind of piggyback off of Wendy, I think the most important thing that I've learned and that I continue to learn is that, you know, who you are is enough. And there's something about who you are authentically and unapologetically that the world needs more of. And I don't think we hear that enough, where we recognize that as an individual, how we show up is a component that's necessary. You know, you don't have to spend time trying to work to be favored or valued or anything like that, because who you are is already valuable. You just have to trust what it is that you have to offer, lean into it. If it scares you, perfect, because that's exactly where you should be. And it helps to just be a good person. You know, it helps to be a good person, because like Alan, Whitney, Jody, yourself, Sharifa, like, you always end up finding people that allow a different, you know, pathway that you didn't see coming before. Just absolutely, like being authentic. So I think that that carries weight. Don't give up on yourself. You're not allowed to give up on yourself.
Absolutely. And is that what you discuss on your podcast? Tell us a little bit about where we can tune into your podcast.
So it's called the Bird Brain Podcast. The funny story about that is, real quick, is I got the name because birds, you know, people see birds as like, oh, they're dumb. They don't have really a very wide concept of intelligence. And then I was like, well, if you think about it, when a bird is in an uncomfortable climate, it travels to go somewhere better. As humans, we don't always do that. We stay, we endure, we let things weigh us down. And with the podcast, I just talk about staying elevated, having a bird's eye view on your everyday living situations and having a different perspective. Maybe you can't get through this situation in this moment, but now you have a different avenue or a different approach to what's going on. And
I think that's beautiful. I think that's wonderful. Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
You can just listen to it anywhere you listen to podcasts, iTunes, Spotify. It's on all the platforms and it's also on YouTube, so.
Thank you. Thank you. Alan, what do you have for us?
Well, you know, I'm looking at all of the other four people here and thinking, what do we have in common? And what is so wonderful is that we're all sharing ourselves and our talent to make this a better world.
Right.
And that is so touching. And so for your listeners, you know, you may not be a writer, you may not be a gymnast or an actor or whatever it is, but you have a certain talent that you need to share with the world. And if you don't, I think one of the biggest sins is being having a God-given talent and not using it. So go out, use your talent, even if it's just making a cake or cookies for someone and giving someone a cookie like Isaiah got. Because the more you give to other people, more comes back to you. So use your talent, enjoy your life, and give to receive, just give.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Give, give, give. Jody, what do you have for us?
Man, everybody has had such great points, and I guess I want to add them all together because it seems like we're all thinking on the same line. And mine, it would be to take time to mentor. All of us have talent, all of us have hard work, but all of us were able to accomplish what we wanted to in life because somebody lent us a hand. It wasn't a handout, it was a hand up. And remember that. Look at a young person, give them the chance, whether it's that gymnast and what Wendy saw in Gabby or what your mentor saw in you, Isaiah. Just give them a chance.
I think that's beautiful. Where can we pick up a copy of Master of Deceit?
Master of Deceit is on Amazon, and it's in Barnes and Noble on their ebook, and all over. So I hope you read it. I tried to make it a quick read. It's not, Alan, don't, it's probably not to your level, but I hope it's a beautiful narrative.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for being guests on today's episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. And I especially want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch this show live, as well as everyone who is watching the show in the archives. Just because you didn't catch the live show does not mean you're not still important. We still need your support. We still need you to go ahead and share the show. And most importantly, we need you to go ahead and support our guests. Their information is in the Facebook post. Visit their websites, follow them on social media. And when you send them that initial message, please let them know Sharifa Hardy says hi. Now, if you're interested in more ways that I can help your business, or maybe you want to pick up your tickets to my New Year, New You 2-day teleconference on December 29th and 30th, or maybe you want to be a guest on the Roundtable Talk Show, please visit my website at asksharifa.com. Until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Pacific time, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you.